Advent. Advent means coming. From the Latin word adventus, and demarks a season of expectantly preparing to celebrate the first coming of Jesus, while eagerly awaiting his second coming to establish his kingdom. Even as we celebrate his presence among us through the promised Holy Spirit. Are you anticipating, expectantly preparing to celebrate the first coming while eagerly awaiting his second coming? Are you eagerly awaiting his second coming? He's not going to come the second time as he did the first time. It's going to be maybe a little more noise, a little more activity that is to take place at that time. What a day that'll be when he comes back. When he returns, praise his name, praise his name. If you have your Bibles with you, you want to turn and follow along in the reading in Isaiah chapter 9. I've already read verse number 2, but I'm going to read it again. Actually, why don't you read it? Could we do that? Read Isaiah 9, verses 2 through 7. Okay? A little bit like responsive reading, only not responsive. You're just going to read it all. You know how to do that, don't you? Okay. Verse number 2 beginning. The people that's good. Thank you. Hope. Hope in Jesus. Over this Advent season, we're going to be looking at unwrapping the names of Jesus. Someone has done a fair amount of study and put together a devotion, a daily devotional, and for Advent, and I'm just going to take that and use it in our Sunday mornings and maybe even Sunday nights, because there's a whole lot of information, there's a whole lot of material, there's a whole lot to be said about unwrapping the names of Jesus. And to get it all said in a little bit of time on Sunday mornings may be a little difficult, so we'll see what happens. But Jesus, what is this name Jesus? Matthew's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 21, it tells us that someone, referring to Mary, was to give birth to a son, and that they were to call his name Jesus because. That means that there was a reason behind this particular name, this particular birth. because he shall save his people from their sins. The name Jesus is a transliteration of the Hebrew name Joshua. And Joshua meant in the Old Testament, the Lord is salvation. The Lord is salvation. Now, in Bible times, it was not uncommon for people to be called Jesus. There was a lot of Jesuses in Jesus' day. It wasn't uncommon. Now it's more uncommon for us to hear the name Jesus. But in some cultures, even today, there's a lot of people that name their child, their son, Jesus. And so even in Jesus' day here, we find that it wasn't uncommon for him to be called Jesus, and it didn't place anything out of the ordinary on his life because of that. You know, we understand that the people that Jesus grew up with, the people that were around him, at one point asked the question, is not this the carpenter? He's just the common dude over here in the carpenter's house. Well, what's the big deal here with this guy? They had a hard time understanding that this Jesus was a different Jesus. There was a specific thing about this Jesus. His name for himself held great significance of who he was and what he was to do on this earth. In the Old Testament, Joshua led the Israelites into Canaan. He saved a lot of people. He led a lot of people. It was quite a feat that Joshua did. There was courageous leadership involved. He charged into battle. It wasn't just something that was, you know, that you talk about around the breakfast table. It was gruesome. Those battles were horrible, horrible situations. And he led this group of people into the promised land. And in contrast to that first Joshua, the second Joshua, Jesus, went through an incredible battle. Someone would say it was an epic battle. And he fought that battle alone. He fought it by himself. He fought it quietly, making the way for people to enter the promised land of God's presence. Jesus came to save his people from their sins. He came to save his people from their sins. What the first Joshua was powerless to do, the second Joshua was born to accomplish. And Jesus did accomplish it. Now, during the lifetime of Christ, when Jesus was actually on this earth, the Israelites were waiting for a political leader like Joshua who would free them from that oppressive rule of the Romans. They wanted another challenging Joshua. They were looking for somebody to step up in militant might. Somebody said that they were looking for a macho man. And I think that we could understand that. That's what they were looking for. That's what they thought they needed. They needed somebody who was going to flex their muscles and defeat the Roman oppression that they had lived under. But Jesus' perspective was different from that. Isn't that the way it is all the time? His perspective is different from our perspective. Jesus shares that multiple times in the time that he walked this earth and recorded in the Gospels. He said, "You have heard it of old, but I say unto you," his perspective was always so different, contrasting sometimes from what was commonly thought and commonly believed. And so when we realize this particular picture, we have to see that it's the same thing as well. His perspective was different from the perspective of the people that were around him. His gaze was on the dilemma of sin way more than it was on the dilemma of oppression. Well, we could stop right there and realize how often it is for ourselves. We get our eyes fixed on the problems that we experience rather than realizing that there's a greater thing in dealing with. There's a spiritual aspect. There's something else that is a bigger picture that Jesus has in his vision and in his gaze he's looking at. And so when we see that Jesus is looking at the universal dilemma of sin, his battle was such of great proportion. He wasn't concerned so much about the Roman rule, but he was concerned about the bondage of the soul and sin and bringing people into the family of God. Because he came to save his people from their sins. What are our expectations of Christ? Do we have any expectations? I suppose that we do. We could probably spend a little bit of time looking at that and talking about the expectations that we have of Christ. Are we expecting him to do something for us in the way of finances? Are we expecting him to do something for us in the way of healing somebody that we love or mending a marriage or some other? What kind of a request is it that we have for him? Some kind of an expectation that we have for him? He very well may do that, but he may not. Especially the way that we expect him to do it. Because his perspective is different from our perspective. Jesus, thou shalt call his name Jesus. And if we unwrap that name, we very quickly understand that unwrapping that name brings us to the realization that Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. That's what he proclaimed in John chapter 11, verse 25. He said it very plainly, very clearly, I am the resurrection and the life. You've probably run into people, and maybe you've known them personally. Perhaps you're one of them at some point have been afraid of death. A lot of people's greatest fear is death. Maybe it's because they don't know God, they don't know Jesus, they don't understand what is to take place after death. And so that unknown that awaits them is frightening to them. In the story of Lazarus in the New Testament, Mary and Martha were facing the reality of death when that brother died. He had a severe illness and he died. Now, it's very likely that Lazarus was Mary and Martha's sole protector, sole provider. There's no indication anywhere that either one of them had a husband or that their parents were still alive. It seems as though Lazarus was their only help in the way of protection and provisions. Martha, some way, demonstrated a little bit of faith in Jesus when she told him that you can ask God because God will give you anything that you ask him. Whatever you ask, he'll do for you. But she didn't fully understand that Jesus was the resurrection and the life. She believed that he could ask for something, but she didn't really believe, didn't understand that he was the resurrection. The power of life and death are in Jesus. Mark that down in your mind. at least. Highlight that in your mind. The power of life and death are in Jesus. He spoke the worlds into existence. He breathed into the nostrils of Adam and he became a living soul. His breath breathed into and he fashions and forms every child in a mother's womb. That includes all of us. He fashioned and formed every single one of us. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:54, death has been swallowed up in victory. How is that he could say that? It's because Jesus rose to life. We who believe in him have also been raised to new life with him. Although we groan with creation, with all of creation under the weight of the current decay that death and sin causes. But we do not mourn with those that have no hope. Because we have hope in Jesus. He is the resurrection and the life. Paul went on to say in 1 Corinthians 15:55, "Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting?" He is the resurrection and life. Jesus is the resurrection and life. Jesus is also the King of Kings. When Jesus was born, it was really an unusual birth, wasn't it? We know that. We've studied about it. We've read about it. We've heard about it. It was an unusual birth. In Matthew, he records in the second chapter, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? We've seen his star in the east, and we've come to worship him." At the beginning of Jesus' life and at the end of Jesus' life, the Gentiles proclaimed the kingship of Christ. These magi that were coming from a long distance away, they were not Jewish people. They were coming in and they recognized there was something that they believed that told them that the King, the Messiah, was born. The King of the Jews. At his death, Pilate put on the cross, had written down and put on the cross, acknowledging that he was the King of the Jews. It was the crime that they said that he was proclaiming, that he professed himself to be. And so Pilate said, "Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews." Perhaps the most fitting moment of worship in the New Testament is when Jesus entered Jerusalem. And he was victorious in that moment, riding on that donkey. The crowds around him, gathering around him, were praising him and shouting, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." They were crying out, "Peace in heaven, glory in the highest." It was a wonderful time. Maybe it was the most fitting moment of worship in the New Testament. Now, it's very possible that most of the people in that crowd did not even understand that Jesus' kingdom was not of this world. It's very possible that they didn't even grasp all that was taking place. Such praise would befit a King of Kings. King of Kings. King of Kings. Is that a cliche or does that really have meaning? King of Kings. Does that mean that he is the king over all kings? He is the highest king? You know, we can say that and rattle it off our tongue so quickly that we really lose sight of the value that is found in that phrase, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. Jesus came first as a humble king, but he'll return as a warrior king. On his robe, on his thigh, it is written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That's recorded in Revelation 19. This King of Kings, this King of Glory is not absent from his kingdom. We are not trifling with a weakling. We do not worship an incompetent wannabe. We worship the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. Who is the King of Glory? His name is Jesus. The entire universe worships the King of Kings. But as humans, we so often miss out on this privilege. Jesus is the light of the world. He is the light of the world. Let's stand together.